Welcome back. Say, if you like what you're hearing tonight this morning, you might want to check out my weekly syndicated radio program, The Conspiracy Show. For more information, log on to strangeplanet.ca, strangeplanet.ca for a list of affiliates where you can listen to the program. That's The Conspiracy Show. I also have a couple of podcasts I want to tell you about briefly. One is called Conspiracy Unlimited. Are you detecting a theme here? Conspiracy Unlimited drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And you can subscribe and listen at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. And then my other podcast is called The Rock and Roll Twilight Zone. If you love rock and roll and you like the paranormal and strange synchronicities and true crime and unsolved murders, you'll want to check out the Rock and Roll Twilight Zone. It's part of the Jericho Network, and you can subscribe and listen on Apple Podcast and Google Play. New episodes drop every Wednesday at midnight, 12 a.m. Eastern. When we come back, my conversation with Steve Asher as we explore the tortured souls of the insane who are unable to find peace inside the Western State Hospital, formerly the Western Lunatic Asylum of Kentucky. Back with more on Coast to Coast AM. Steve Asher is a former corrections officer with the Kentucky Penitentiary, and he is also an author of Hauntings of the Western Lunatic Asylum. And I wanted to just to dive into that subject area for a moment before we go into the calls. And first of all, the Western Lunatic Asylum, not called that anymore. That's very politically incorrect. Now it's the Western State Hospital. Whereabouts in the state is that located?
Well, Western State Hospital is in Christian County, Kentucky. That's like two counties from me. All these areas that generally I write about in the Hauntings of series are within 35 to 40 miles from me. It's in the western part of the state, and it's located just outside of Hopkinsville, Kentucky, or the township proper. So just like anything, most prisons, junkyards, mental asylums, things like that, the people know they need them. They don't want them downtown, you know, not next to my house type mentality. And right. That's where it was at. It was put out there, the same area back in the time when there was county poorhouses and all that. So all that was in the same little triangle area.
And does the asylum have a resident ghost that is perhaps best known, that has the most notoriety?
Well, there's one that, and that I'd actually have gotten, had actually seen a picture of. I'm not sure if I'd have shown this to you or not. There's a staircase that comes down from, they have a dome at the top of the main building. It's sort of an observation dome, and there's sort of a spiral type staircase that comes down, and there's a gray form there, and they call her the Gray Woman of Western State. And a lot of folks have seen them. A lot of folks have, you know, been coming up or down it, and they pretty much know that it's coming because it get cold. It has sort of a different smell, kind of a smell of, the best way to describe it is, have you ever smelled like the shrubs that are, a lot of times you'll find them in cemeteries, that kind of earthy, damp smell? It's a cross between that and some sort of perfume. And a lot of times you'll know that this is coming because of a slight temperature change and that smell, which most people, if they know that's coming, they get on out of the staircase. Some people, you know, just like anybody else. I mean, I've talked to people at the penitentiary, just like I did it at the hospital, that said, you know, I've never dealt with anything, and my personal beliefs, you know, this and that's not there, which, you know, you tell yourself you're not going to see something, you won't, or you tell yourself you will, you may. So it's very individual basis. But that was one of the ones that kind of stuck with me because it's kind of iconic. And the dome, that was the main thing you really notice when you drive in, because you can see it's a big silver deal, and you see it for probably a good mile or two off, and especially on a bright day, things just beaming. And that's, for me, that was one of the ones that really stand out, that most people in the area know about. And that's the thing, is that people here that are local, you know about some of the hauntings, you know, like I say, at the penitentiary, and know about, like, the orphan walk at the hospital, or know about the old story of Buck, the guy who sets fire to the original buildings, locked himself in a room. They try to get him out, and he said, my work is done, and let himself burn to death with a smile on his face. Now, can that be contributed to a mental state? Absolutely.
I find it remarkable, Steve, that they would house orphans under the same roof as the criminally insane.
Well, but you got to remember, too, it's there was no social safety nets then. You know, this place had been open, the hospital had been open, if I'm not mistaken on my dates, because I don't have any paperwork in front of me. I believe it was 1854. So it was open, you know, almost 30 years before the penitentiary. And that's what would happen sometimes, is that you have someone goes to the county poorhouse, and these children, for whatever reason, are there with the parents or whatever, because there's sometimes people could take them, sometimes they couldn't. A lot of people would bring and drop children at the county poorhouse or at the penitentiary, or not the penitentiary, sorry, the hospital. There were some, like, orphanages and things like that. I think, like, there's a home for the feeble-minded. I believe it's in Louisville. Similarly, people would bring their orphans because they couldn't care for them. And it was like, well, I'd rather them be here than starve on the streets. And it was during that time when classifications were different. You would have people at the penitentiary that you would have, you know, young kids who were in there for stealing whatever, you know, bread and whatever, try to survive or whatever, and have guys in there for murder. I mean, it was just that there was no classifications of crime back then. It was just you're a convict, boom, you're in a cell. That's not to say that was every day, but there were cases of that. And that's another thing that, for me, made the hauntings of the Western Lunatic Asylum different, and in some ways more horrifying, for the fact that, as we've spoke before, we support a lot of advocacy for special needs and epilepsy, and we have two sons. We were adopted. One was an orphan from an orphanage, actually from Thailand, which that story that you were talking about, the children that are trapped in there, really kills me, because, you know, I know people from that region that, you know either know of those children or have some relation and some connection. Their kids went to school with them. You know, we stay in contact with those people because they were very good to our son. So that the book itself brings back a lot of emotions for me. It was a bittersweet book. I loved writing it. I think it was interesting. I think the stories needed to be out. But like I said, it was hard to write, you know, especially when you know that people who are not in complete charge of their faculties, and sometimes in there for no other reason than just being born poor and being in a situation where they basically got institutionalized, or what you would call a socialized retardation, if we can use that term, to where they could not function outside of that environment.
Right. Are there, can you share a story of an interaction either that you've had personally or someone who works at or worked at the hospital has had with perhaps the ghost of an orphan?
Yes, there's an area on the upper floors, and it was a screened-in area that overlooked the grounds. There's like a circle drive in the front, and now they have like doctor's offices and things in the area, but it used to be part of it had been a breezeway for people with TB. Just like in many other institutions, everything has different lines and different eras. Well, there was a lady who was, I guess, a psychology resident, and they were working for the doctors, and they were doing this and that, and they were doing different paperwork and that kind of stuff. That's usually how, when you shadow people, that's one of the things, you catch paperwork. That's the nature of it. That's putting your dues in and all that. So anyway, she had been working late after the offices had been already closed up and was doing different paperwork in an isolated wing, which was a doctor's wing. And she would notice little things, you know, notice like a presence, and just kind of, you know, of course, like everybody, well, shake it off. It's just whatever. You check, make sure there's nobody in the offices. No one's there. Sometimes you maybe hear the sound of somebody walking by or sometimes running by. Then at the far end, you look, thinking maybe it's the custodians. Nobody's there. And all this, each time that she would be working at night, she would notice this. And it got to the point where there had been, where she was coming back, it was had been like storms and had been knocking power and had knocked the power out in the area, which, of course, when they go back to generators, she was coming up through there through the hallway from the main building or from the offices to the main building. And she had felt a presence, and then she felt something actually pulling on like the hem of her skirt. You know, she thought maybe she was catching on whatever, maybe a plant or something in the hallway. You know, a lot of times she'd have doctor's office have stuff kind of decorated. Well, as the lightning was coming down in the flash, she could see what looked like the outline of these children. These little skinny, little grayish, like washed out images, almost like you're looking at, you know, like the old glass stills from the old days, how it had that really kind of yellowy look to it.
Right, like a patina, like a sepia tone.
Exactly, and they had that sort of complexion, and you know, their faces were sunken, their eyes were sunken, and it's obviously they weren't alive. But she looked down, and they're not there, but she could still see like the fabric on her dress being pulled. You know, they weren't doing anything improper. They were just like, help me. You could tell they were pleading, help me. And that was one of these situations. She obviously took off. She had spoke to the custodians, asked everybody who'd been up there, if they've heard anybody, if there'd been children in the building, trying to rationalize it. Like, there has to be a reason, some reason. There'd obviously been nobody there. They really don't keep children at the institution anymore. And that's where she learned that at one time had been where a lot of times children, while they're being treated, they would sit and stare out the window. And a lot of times these children were either special needs or whatever, and they would be with their little faces stuck to the glass waiting for their moms or their dads, thinking that maybe their grandma's going to come get them. You know, this might have been 20 years after their parents are dead. You know, they're still thinking, oh, I'm going home. They're stuck in a perpetual hell, you know, that there is really no escape from. That kills me to think that, you know, obviously these children have had such a horrible life and either aged out or died sometimes in a situation of an institution. The weak or the small are not managed properly, and sometimes they're taken advantage of. So, you know, not a lot of times these young people don't make it, and that really killed me. And that was one of the situations where that was one of the stronger stories in the book where that person ended up leaving the facility. They couldn't do it.
Have you ever attempted to capture EVPs at that location?
Now, the hospital is still under state control. For the most part, I've tried to talk to them about doing a tour, even doing some light investigative work in closed wings. I've not gotten permission for it yet. There's a lot of HIPAA laws, which I understand that. You definitely don't want to infringe on people's privacy and their rights. But so as of yet, no, I've not. At the penitentiary, I was never able to get EVPs at there due to the fact that when I was on shift, you know, they wouldn't let you bring a cell phone in or anything. Definitely not a voice recorder, because they said someone could get a message out to somebody or you could get a message in to somebody. It was very monitored, lockstep type movement. You know, they want to make sure nothing comes in, nothing goes out, which, you know, that's security. Now, I understand that. But I have spoke to the previous warden at the penitentiary about trying to get in there to do some research on EMF fields, because there seems to be a lot of fights in areas where there's high EMF fields. It affects your health. It affects your mental status. It affects your ability to sleep, even your skin. You know, it can cause you to have all kinds of skin issues and problems. And I was never able to get permission. They do have a new warden just recently, and I may try to contact her and see if she would consider it now that I'm no longer an officer. At the time, they said, well, due to the fact that you're a first-line officer, there would be a conflict of interest, so we couldn't allow it, which that's fine. You know, I kind of didn't expect it, but I had to swing. But that doesn't mean that, yeah, if I get the opportunity, I'll definitely want to go in there and do some of that.
Now, you mentioned something about EMF. Are you of the belief then that it's possible that a lot of the violence that's stirred up in the penitentiary may be caused by poltergeist activity?
Well, I do believe that and this is again just bioelectrical mechanics. You know, we all produce a certain frequency. We all produce a certain electromagnetic energy, and we react to that. You know, they have even the military. I mean, I know you've had guests on talk about different types of crowd control and things like that, where they use different type of electromagnetic energies or microwave fields and things like that to cause different reactions in people's bodies. And that's the thing, you know, I mean, if an EMF field is high enough, it's going to cause a lot of confusion, a lot of aggravation. And the thing is, if you already have a volatile populace, anything you put on top of that, you know, is going to make it so much worse. And that's not exactly their fault. You know, if you're primed to go anyway, just by nature, and this is mainly in the segregation units, the older segregation units, that's where most of that you feel, especially on what they call the Tutter's Walk. That would be 14 left in 3 cell house. There's always a very strong presence, and be it from whoever. And a lot of the people would say, well, there's a lot of old wiring in here, and it's not really properly shielded. I'm sure that's what it is, which that's their explanation for, okay, it's not a ghost, which that's fine. But then that brings up that other question of going, okay, well, what is this doing to those people? Not to mention the officers, you know, and I think it was a thing they just didn't want to get into that. They're thinking, great, so now if this is shown that there's a correlation, wow, we're looking at probably several million dollars in rewiring this place and reshielding this and putting all kinds of different filters on this and that. So, but yeah, I do think that there's some truth in that. And I mean, as of my own particular belief in what a ghost is, I think it's all the hangover from your electromagnetics from your body. I mean, everything's electric. You know, there's the power's there. It's just, I don't think it just goes away. I think it changes into something else.
Right. That makes sense. I hesitate to mention this. I don't. First of all, let me say I am the least intuitive person I know. But I have a scratch pad here where I jot down notes, and for some reason, I wrote. It's almost like a case of automatic writing. This has never happened to me before. I'm just gonna throw it out there. I'm gonna take a flyer here, folks, on live radio. I keep writing the name King and drawing a crown for some reason for the last half hour. I don't know why. It is. Does that name mean anything, or that word King or crown or chief? Does that mean anything to you?
Well, I mean, that's kind of an old prison related thing. I'm sure you have heard the term shot caller.
No, I have not.
Okay. Well, a shot caller basically is what we would call the granddads, the older inmates that handle cell houses. Okay, the way it worked, even when I hired in, generally you would have the hierarchy of the older inmate. Okay, there's convicts and there's inmates. Convicts are people that have been in the system long enough to know how it runs, to know where they can go, where they can't go with officers, and generally keep the crowd down, they're kind of like the foremen of whatever construction group, and then you're trying to come in there, but they're managing it to keep your headaches down, which keeps their headaches down. And a lot of time, King or shot caller ties in with that. There's also a lot of gang affiliations, which uses kings. You know, you got folks, you know, Crips and Bloods and stuff like that, which ties in. They use a lot of crown symbolism. Let me ask you, did your crown happen to be 5-point or a 6-point crown?
Let me see here. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 5.
Okay, we'll see.
5.
That would tie in, I think, more with Crips. So it's strange that you did that, because like I said, I mean, that's really weird.
Listen, I got to do a little cliffhanger here. I'll get your explanation for what I drew on my paper when we come back. Steve Asher stays with us. We'll open up the phones again, particularly if you're a corrections officer. Would love to hear your stories. This is rather odd for me. As I mentioned earlier, I am the least intuitive person I know. In fact, when it comes to psychic ability, I tend to be very skeptical. I don't discount it entirely. I tend to be skeptical. And yet, for the last half hour, in conversation with Steve Asher, who is with us on the line, the author of Hauntings of the Western Lunatic Asylum and Hauntings of the Kentucky State Penitentiary, I started sketching on my little scratch pad that I always have with me here on my studio desk. I started drawing crowns. And then the word king. And a couple of times I wrote chief. And so I asked Steve just before the last break what that was all about and if he might have an explanation. Is there a connection? And he mentioned that there might be, and we'll explore that a little bit further on the other end, on the other side rather, and also take more of your calls. Particularly, would love to hear from corrections officers. If you've worked in a state prison and you have a paranormal story to share, we would love to hear it. Steve Asher on the other side, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And we are back with paranormal researcher, author, former penitentiary guard in Kentucky, Steve Asher. Steve, I don't want to dwell on this too long. It's just kind of a curious little thing that happened. I started drawing these crowns and writing the word king over and over again for no particular reason, so I thought I'd ask you about it and to see if there is a connection. And you were explaining something about, was it the Crips or the Bloods? This is a gang symbol.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you if you haven't been listening to the band Chicago recently, or maybe had the song, some of the Chicago songs come to your mind, because the five-point star was pretty much a Latin kings-related gang symbol, and which formed around the 1940s in Chicago prisons. That's kind of where that built up from. You're having kind of like East Coast, West Coast rivalries. And that, as guys got in and out of prison, they started setting up their own cells outside and building and amassing area and amassing soldiers and foot soldiers. And you're talking about chiefs, you know, you have different people. It's a hierarchy, because you would have, you know, you'd have the main guys, you'd have, like you said, the chiefs, the lieutenants, the different shot callers to the different crews under them. You know, it's very, very mechanized and very militaristic setup in regards of how it is in the hierarchy of it. And, which is really strange, because, you know, in the penitentiary, you know, you have a captain, lieutenant, sergeant, whatnot. So it's almost like a big chessboard. But it's that's what I was sitting there thinking about that, and I was like, well, yeah, maybe he's picking up on a Latin kings sort of element.
You know, it's also very strange. During the break, back in Los Angeles in the L.A. studio, Nathan just informed me that Donna Walker, our call screener, has been watching an Elvis documentary. He just told me this, and so maybe that's where the king was coming from, or maybe it has something to do with the gang symbol. I don't know, but there it is. Make of that what you will.
Well, I'll say this, you know, being a Southerner, and you know, if the king's in the room, maybe that's a good sign. Maybe he's overlooking the proceedings, and all is going to be okay.
All right. East of the Rockies, Joe is on Long Island. Joe, welcome to Coast. Good morning.
You know, what I want to ask you is related phenomena in the state of Kentucky. I know you have Fort Knox there, where there's supposedly gold and a huge army base, really, historically. And I'm wondering if any stuff from the deeper stuff.
Joe, we're losing you. We're losing you on your line. But Fort Knox or any other paranormal phenomena in Kentucky?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that most people, you think of Kentucky paranormal, you think of Waverly, like Waverly Hills, maybe Octagon Hall. West Kentucky University has, you know, a history of that. But, you know, the area that I'm in, obviously, which is, you know, in Western Kentucky, the sort of facilities that I would mention, like the penitentiary, you know, Western State Hospital. There is an old facility called Outwood, which is in Dawson Springs, not 13 miles from me. You know, there's so many different places like that. And because we have all the different mines, you know, you have a plethora of different mine collapses and explosions and floods and drownings. And there's just, I mean, it's easier to tell you where there's not a witch tree or a whatever than to say that there's not. I think part of that, too, is just the kind of Southern tradition of oral stories, and that's what people hold on to. You know, that's the thing. You know, my mother was Appalachian, landed. She was actually French Huguenot bloodline, had landed in that, you know, the Appalachian part of Kentucky, and they slowly filtered into this area. And so, picked up a whole lot of different little local ghost stories. That's one thing I think that Kentucky's very rich in, because most people, just like if you say if you're a foreigner and you think of U.S., you think, oh, well, New York, L.A., you know, kind of the coastal areas, which is where more people visit. But like I said, that's the thing here, is that there's a rich history of great, of wonderful things and not so wonderful things. But the ghost lore is very strong, much like, again, back to Thailand. When we were there, me and my wife, we were there adopting one of our sons. There's so much ghost culture there. It's wild. I mean, you have banana ghosts, you know, when you cut bananas off trees, you have to thank the ghost before you take it, or they can follow you home. You drop food on the floor, don't pick it up. That's for the hungry ghost, or they'll come back and they'll kill you in your sleep. There's so much, you know, folklore and superstition, and that all ties in together. And I don't devalue a ghost story from a wives' tale to whatever. You know, that's what I always tell people in regards to the books. You know, if you don't necessarily believe in spirits, or if you believe whatever, or just can't even open your mind up to it, just take it as a good ghost story, a good campfire story, and hopefully you'll get something out of it.
Do you believe that the ghosts that inhabit the Western Hospital or the Kentucky State Penitentiary, do you believe these ghosts have consciousness, or are they sort of a spiritual residue, just kind of an endless loop, kind of a memory stored in the walls of these buildings?
You know, I would say probably, if I've had to put it into percentages, I'd probably a good 75 to 80 are just looping residual haunts, are poltergeist activity, be it from a spirit or from some other natural phenomenon that's causing whatever. But I do think there's a percentage of that are sentient, that have some remnant of consciousness, even on a more primal lizard brain level of just going, oh, someone's here, I'm activated, I'm moving around, why are you here, why are you in my cell? You know, because the way we always looked at ghosts, because, you know, we do paranormal investigations. Me and my wife, we have a group called the Caldwell County Paranormals, and we had, you know, anytime we would ever go check stuff out, we didn't go in there with the whole vibe of, well, we're ghost hunters. Well, I don't have a ghost head on my wall. I'm not, you know, that's not what it's about for us. It's about, you know, first of all, it's about the people that's living in whatever situations, generally in homes or whatever, that maybe have children that are afraid. We want to find out if it's a thing that they can live with, if it's something they can help cross over, and that it's not, know that it's not going to hurt the children. But it's also a thing that these, if they were people, if that's what a spirit actually is, and that's open to conjecture, these were people at one time too, and they're going to respond in kind to, you know, if you treat them right, you know, they're going to respond properly. Just like if you go in there and try to, you know, I've talked to you about the whole kind of come at me, bro, flexing up on ghosts. I feel is foolhardy and disrespectful. And especially if you feel it's something that's a negative entity, that's not the way to do that. You're going to end up catching some flack from that, and it may be something that you know, can't walk away from.
Steve is in Sacramento, California. He's a former corrections officer. Steve, good morning. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hey, thank you.
Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, my experience with this relevant to the prisons was back in, I think it was 88. That would have been 88 or 89. I was working the first watch in one of the older wings in Tracy, California. That's an older prison, not as old as San Quentin or Folsom, but pretty old. Used to be the Gladiators School, a lot of tough homicides, you know, big time knives and things like that that took a lot of people out. And I was locked into my housing unit for the night, doing my counts, and then stationed in my officer station. And I experienced my semi-peripheral vision, the image of two inmates up on the third tier out loose. And at that time of night, that would have been a problem. That would have been an escape or escape attempt. And it was so real that I stood up and went to depress my alarm, which is what you're supposed to do. And yet, bam, I stopped because they suddenly disappeared. And I was like, okay, what's going on here? So I reflexively pulled out my big four-cell mag light and hit that thing all over the place. Nothing's there. And at this point, I go, okay, am I going to don't want to face humiliation that just inmates out or not. So I kind of wrestled with my pride, and I was young, I was in my 20s, and kind of like wanted to be tough or whatever. And so I took my full drat and key, the big key, and I keyed myself into the housing unit. I went up there, up through the whole area, but up there first. And I did a complete check, a complete count. I checked all the doors, and I was just like, okay. And I reasoned with myself that it had to be too much coffee. And that was the story I told myself and accepted and went home with. And then about a year later, I was out on the outer duty on different assignment towers where you got a lot of time talking to the tower officers. And I started to hear these tales from these other officers who worked in the prison, different shifts, different times. And then I went, son of a gun, that's what happened to me. And the guy goes, yeah, he goes, there's a ghost, man. This place has ghosts in it. And they all had, you know, different officers in different areas they work. And I think it's prevalent. I think it's prevalent in older prisons because of the way that the type of homicides that would occur with the bigger knives back then. And I think it's something that the guest on tonight just said, something that resonates with me. You need to treat these things with respect. And I think I'm really glad to hear that he's doing that. That he's not doing a, you know, like a kind of a hunt for this type of thing. I think that the living souls that remain here are trapped because they have unresolved issues, and their electrical like energy that remains needs to find a way out. And I would be curious if he ever discovers any kind of a thing that happens where there's a relief to get these guys out of here and to get them to move on, so they're not giving people a hard time. And I mean that because besides this one incident, that was my earliest thing, I'm somebody that's had so much more than this happened ever since then. And so it's expanded on that. But thank you for letting me call in and comment on that.
Thank you, Steve. Great call.
Okay,
Steve, to the other Steve, did you want to comment on Steve from Sacramento and his comments?
Absolutely. And the first thing is you can tell when somebody has had an experience and they're not, you know, like sometimes you can tell when somebody's like, yeah, so I was levitated off the ground and this and that was going on. And you heard, you know, like the rain of locusts and frogs. I mean, you can really tell somebody's like, look, this is, I'm not crazy, but this is what I saw. That is so indicative of the sort of conversations I would have. And you would have that thing where no one wants to say a word because you don't want to look batty. But if you have somebody that you can trust, you know, 9 times out of 10, they're going to go, yeah, I've seen that too. Or they'll kind of go, well, I didn't see that, but have you heard about it over on so-and-so? And then you start, that floodgates open. I do believe that, and I would have been curious to ask Steve if he had also had more experiences, because he said, like, it seemed like it ramps up, because it seems like there's a watershed moment where, like, oh, you can see us now, or boom, okay, you're open, or you're
Oh, that's interesting. That's the way it happens. There's a kind of a there's that first experience, and that opens the floodgates. Fascinating. He's no longer with us, but I'll tell you who is with us. East of the Rockies, Bruce is in Ohio. He's a former deputy sheriff in Akron. Bruce, welcome to Coast.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
We used to have a woman's jail, and on the second floor was the sergeant's office. And during the middle of the night, the typewriter, this is going back in the day when we had typewriters, but the typewriter started going off. And this story made the regional newspaper, but the typewriter typed out almost a full page about the the Headless Horseman and hell and everything that was going on. But there was nobody on the second floor.
Wow.
Someone recovered the piece of paper and they found the story of the Headless Horseman,
absolutely Sleepy, right. And
as in the story, the Sleepy Hollow, the Headless Horseman from the Sleepy Hollow?
I don't know. It just, somebody gave it to a local reporter and it got put in the newspaper. But that was absolutely freaky.
Go ahead, Steve.
As the institution that I'd worked at was so old, you would have similar stuff. Because, like I said, obviously, they would go into word processors and then mount, laptops and, pads or whatever. But you would have that type of thing. You would have via a teletype or something like that. Or you would have, like, the slam gates, because everything is, all the gates are taken up from upstairs, because they used to have gates separating the different floors, and then they ended up removing those barriers because of, fire hazards and stuff. But you would still sometimes hear that door swinging open, that low creak, and it just goes right through you because you're gone. There's not a gate up there anymore. And that sort of thing. Yeah, it's very much, it's telling. It sounds like somebody was burning the midnight oil, and in the afterlife, it sounded like.
Bruce, thank you. Great call. The guards that you talk to, Steve, do they fear the violence from the inmates more, or do they fear the ghosts and the paranormal activity more?
Wow. Well, Richard, for me, I made my peace with the dead a long time ago. It's a thing where, especially if it's something that, that you're not ready for, if you don't have the underpinning for that or any sort of life experiences from that, the first time that you encounter something like that is horrifying. So it depends on the officer, honestly. But I've had, like I said, I've had a lot of folks that dealt with stuff and would call me up after a while, people knowing that I was kind of the resident ghost guy. I mean, it's sort of a weird thing to be known as, but, they knew I was sympathetic to it and, maybe would have some explanations and stuff. But usually I could kind of explain to them the situation, explain that it's not anything other than just a looping, it's just a reflective echo of something that happened a long time ago. And some people can absorb it and some people can't, overall, I would say that they were, I wouldn't necessarily be afraid of the inmates, but they are definitely more worried about the living than dead.
Well, what's next in your haunting series, Steve?
Well, right now I'm working on the book about the St. Vincent's Academy. That's up in the Morganfield, Kentucky area in Union County. And it's got all kinds of stuff that's tied in with that. The area was a very large Catholic population. And so a lot of the initial property was, places, like monasteries and churches and...
Right.
Like,
but we'll look forward to that one, Steve. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but we'll have you back on and talk about that. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you, sir.
For George Norrie, George Napoli, Salines, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galanti, Sean Latasor, Chris Burrows, Nathan Staten, and Donna Walker. Here in Toronto, Mike Ben Dixon, Robert Turner, Patrick O'Neill, I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. Until tonight, so long for now.